think about the all the dimensions that are covered in Lewis's writing and in the writings of all of these inkling writers. I get so frustrated because I think, well, I really should talk about that. I should talk about that. And then I write this down, then I turn this page down, and then I go back over this, and the problem with selection is, well, it's a frightful thing to have to undergo. And particularly with C.S. Lewis, whom I've known much longer than any of the other writers that I have talked about. But I decided today to talk about some things in Lewis that are probably not so well known to you in terms of your own reading, because they're maybe not available to you, or they haven't been on your assigned list. And I think that's one good thing about having somebody pick something on Lewis. There's no point in going back over the things that you already know. It would be fun to sit down and, you know, sort of be cozy about Narnia or the science fiction books, or even review The Abolition Man, on which you could no doubt speak in much more terms than I can. But I thought it was probably better to talk about Lewis in a broader aspect and try to nail down some of the things that he was attempting to produce in his writings, and what he actually did produce in all of us as we read of what he's written. You are very fortunate that a book has just come out, and I think I forgot it, but just for that minute, because I have a lot of quotes in it that I want to read. It's a book by Homer on C.S. Lewis's life and thought. I think it's here on the table now. Paul Homer, who is a professor at Yale Divinity School, has written a book on C.S. Lewis called Lewis. It's not only his life and thought, but his theology and his literary work combined to produce the kind of reflection on his work that gives us, I think, kind of a new insight and a new way to put together this mass of impressions that we all have, most of them positive, about Lewis's writing. One of the things that I think that Homer brings out is, he, by the way, is a very interesting fellow. We've asked him to come to the village a couple of times, and he's all set to come, and then he got into the hospital for some reason or other, or just kind of dropped out of sight. And we talked to other people who had invited him to be part of a seminar or a program, and had discovered that the thing just occurred when they invited him to come. Sometimes he's there and sometimes he isn't. Well, this is one of the things about brilliant people. They're not always as dependable as you might like. But one of the interesting things about Paul Homer was that he was a professor at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Philosophy. And he came over to Luther Seminary a couple of times to lecture. And Carol remembers when he was teaching at Luther, and Paul came over to talk. And he gave such a vital kind of stirring up lecture to the seminary students. And he said that, sort of at the end of it, that he thought that it was really a tragedy that he, a professor from the university, a secular school, had to come to the university and be for the seminary an inspiration. He said, "You should be inspiring us." He said, "What's the matter with you over here?" And perhaps that is what urged him to go to Yale Divinity and become a member of the faculty there, rather than to continue at the University of Minnesota. He was another one of David Sanchin's admirers, and I think he also had him in class, as I did, so I had a lot of feeling of identity with him, with Paul Homer, and he really is a very, very incisive person, a very, really seminal kind of teacher, and a person that always cuts right through. And this book that he's written, oh, this is it, the CSS, The Shape of His Faith, Faith and Thought. And it's a Harper and Row book. It wasn't cheap, I know. I think it was, he actually, when did you graduate from? He delivered the first series of some of these lectures at Seton, under the Wade series at Seton. And he has done a great job in Seton College in Illinois in really backing up the group of writers that we know as the Inklings. I think they did it partly because they realized that here was a group of men who actually were grasping again the basic truth of the Christian faith. I'm sure they're aware that these writers don't all identify with a strict interpretation of some of the truths that Seton College is certainly concerned about, but they realize, on the other hand, that this is a new way of approaching these very fundamental truths, and I say hats off to them for seeing this and going ahead and having an inkling room at their library, in which they have their they have a lot of the manuscripts and the first editions and I think they have all the books of the Inkling group in that library. And it's also why Erdman's publishing company, I think, has done such a great job in making available all these Williams books, for instance, to us, and the Dorothy Sayers, I'm sure would publish the Lewis books as soon as they're available to be reprinted again and out of not under the copyright of some other publisher. It takes real imagination and money usually to do that kind of thing, but it's a great thing that you can get both of them together. But I've asked Meredith to order this for the library here. But those of you who won't be here, I'm sure you can find this in not only in the regular bookstores and in the libraries, but you should probably find it in some of the religious and Christian bookstores. I'm sure it would be at the church publishing house bookstores and also in other Christian bookstores, because Lewis is synonymous for most people with a Christian apologist. Now, he is not really a Christian apologist. He himself would not say he's making any kind of apology for the Christian faith. He's not writing a new set of definitions or defenses for Christianity. He simply is examining the nature of man and the nature of reality, of the world in which man lives, and how does this all fit together in terms of man's relationship with the truths that Lewis discovered brand new for him in Christianity. And that's what makes him so exciting, is because for him, Christianity is a moment. It's a real momentous event, and it radically changed his whole way of interpreting life and his teaching and his writing and even his interpretation of literature. he, like all the rest of the inklings, are people who did their homework. They're none of them fluffy heads. None of them live on their emotions. All of them are people who actually learn their Greek, they learn their Latin, they learn their English grammar, they read their classics, they studied them, they were able to teach them, they were workmen that didn't have to be ashamed of their work and defended on the basis of the fact that, but we're Christians. You know, and the Holy Spirit will somehow cover up the mistakes. I have to keep it on school because it's such a deep, deep error in our thinking that somehow miracles take place. You know, even if we haven't studied, Lord, help me pass this exam. You know, I mean well. I mean, and that's supposed to take, cover our whole, you know, everything we do. Well, none of the inklings allow for that kind of sloppy, dishonest thinking. And he one of the reasons that he is such, he is a person that people respect from all ranges of life is the fact that he is a man who has actually, he actually knows where he speaks. He doesn't speak off the top of his head. He really has ground this out and sweated it out so that he knows what he's talking about. Now, one of the things that Homer is concerned about is the fact that Lewis is really involved in the development of consciousness on the part of every human being. In other words, that you and I as human beings have a consciousness of ourselves that is important and radical to whether or not we become full-blown individuals under God. Now, you may think, well, does that mean self-consciousness? You mean that we're supposed to be sort of, you know, self-consciously tuning our keys and being sure that this leaf is going in the right place and that leaf is coming out at the right place and so on, that we're somehow supposed to be aware cosmetically of our lives as individuals. And Homer certainly would not say that Lewis is saying that, and I wouldn't say it. Because Lewis is anything but a person who wants people to be very much aware of how am I doing, man? Am I improving? And where am I? I'm better this week than I was last week, and look what I've read this week, and how much I've learned, and so on. But what he's referring to is simply the fact that our lives ought to be lives that are alert and are paying attention to the world around us. And in doing that, we are unconsciously raising our consciousness. In other words, that as we make the choices of what we pay attention to, of what we enjoy, of what we do, of what we read, that we are literally developing the consciousness that is part of our right, our birthright, our freehold, as members of the Christian kingdom. And as you read Lewis, you are very much aware of this. You're aware of this sentence even in the Narnia book. Do you remember in the Magician's Nephew, when the little boy, I forget his name now, what's his name? Is going to help his mother. He's got to find something to help his mother, and he's given Aslan, isn't it, to tell him to get the fly over to the middle of this big forest, and then he has to find this one tree and pick an apple from this tree. Sort of a reverse Garden of Eden thing, and when he does that, he has some conflict does it really mean that I should go the whole way? Should I do the whole thing exactly as it says, or would it be all right if I didn't have to do everything exactly as I was told? I mean, there's a real sense of choice here as to, batting back and forth, oh, maybe you didn't mean it to me. And you and I can recognize this very definitely in the way in which we deal with any kind of temptation. Oh, and in fact, Kierkegaard says, the root temptation is when you hear a little voice that says, oh, the Lord will not give us to you to with me, really. And that can't possibly be that important a person that I'm being paid attention to. And this is what is happening to Diggory, and it happens in any kind of temptation in which we belittle ourselves, and by doing it, we pretend that we're being, underneath, we pretend that we're being more modest, but actually we're trying to avoid a decision, trying to avoid doing something that is involving a choice that is going to be hard to make, and that is going to be probably lead us into a little more work than we had intended. But the choice that Diggory makes is finally the right one. He decides he better obey. Not anything great and glamorous, he just has to do what he's told. And this is something else that Lewis is always insisting on, that with our much vaunted emphasis on originality and being ourselves and so on, I don't deny the fact that I'm all for affirming people being themselves, and I feel like more people have a tendency to be sort of stamped and female-y. But Lewis is very cautious about this, because he says we really need to understand what it means to obey and to do the things that have to be done, and they may be the nitty-gritty, and yet that's where we have to be found in order to find that eventually the choices will be made in the right direction. And I remember a funny little phrase that used to be bandied about when I was in grade school, and oh, it haunted me almost all my life. You are what you are when you're not being seen, or something like that. And sort of the idea that it's what you do, when nobody knows, nobody hears, and that's who you are. And that's always stuck with you. And really, Lewis says that, and he does not say it in such a banal form, but he does give you the implication that when as you continually make choices like this, you are continually building up the kind of attention and alertness to all of the things that really make life so that life has the value and the validity that God himself gives to it. And our particular part in it is not a kind of a working out our own salvation, or that it's our work that are doing it. It's simply that's how people grow. And you grow by the choices you make. Lewis's understanding of the Christian faith, for him, meant that you don't believe the Christian faith up here and not straighten out a lot of other thoughts and things about your life elsewhere. Christian faith is not something that is a little category on itself. It has ramifications in every single area of your life. And Lewis found this to be true, and he talked about it continually in all of his writings. Everything he says has to do with the way in which the Christian faith runs like water into every lowest possible spot in your life and consciousness. He makes the case, Paul Homer says, for the forgotten strategy of achieving the capacities and abilities that rightly belong to our common human nature. That's his book to address us as human beings, but we're not convinced by an argument addressed or stated for us. We don't sense the argument for us until we've begun to realize something about ourselves. And this is what happens when you read his novels and when you really give yourself to his essays. That it isn't, you don't just get a statement that is quotable and you can write it down in a book and say, oh, that's really great. But actually, you read and something has to happen to you. This is so part and parcel of his writing that it's almost as if it would be a lie to say you've read Lewis and nothing had happened to you. You haven't read it. If nothing has happened to you when you read it. Because that's the kind of writing it is. You have to become the subject of the material, and you have to begin to know inside of the writing what is going on. That's why when you read the Narnia book, you're not reading about something. You're in it. You know, you are used to getting the scales clawed off you by Aslan. You are Lucy. You are Peter. You're any one of those people. You are even the person remember the little girl. The little girl that had to be sure that she obeyed exactly. She had to say things in the right order. Remember she had to say things in the right order, and if she didn't say them in the right order, there was something bad would happen, and it did. You know, and it was wrong when she didn't. And this is, you know, we can just read it wrong because we read it well, of course. But actually, when you enter into that book, think of the Narnia books are in terms of their externality, so this is a good story. Well, they can be read that way, of course. But when you enter into them, you realize, oh, how quickly we all want to circumvent, you know, the simplicity of doing it just in the right order. And why do we have to do it that way? And why does God insist that it has to be done that way? And yet, this is propounding in all of these books, that there is an order to the way things are done. And it's not up to us to make the order. The order is there. And very hard for most Americans, I think, to understand that, because we have come out of an entirely different background from the English background and the English educational background that Lewis had. We have a much more of a feeling of, I'll do it my way, you know, the pioneer spirit and the frontier originality and so on. I think there's something in us all of that nature. And yet, Lewis is a good corrective for that, because he says there is an order and a type of structure that we have to enter into if we're going to understand the whole meaning of life and the universe and God and all the realities that we like to bandy about rather lightly. And he said we have to enter into them and experience them and know in the sense of really knowing. And he uses in the word for know, he uses the French word connect and savoir, which have two different meanings. One of them, connect, is to know something really, as you know a person intimately. And savoir is just to know something, well, you know the expression savoir faire. You know, once you know what to do, or you know what to do, there's a certain amount of, well, you know what the fine word is for that, isn't it? Or perhaps you don't, because I suppose that's way back then, too. Savvy. You know, S-A-V-V-Y, I don't even know what that means. Well, is my flip showing off? It does mean, it comes from the French word savoir. I never even read Nancy Drew. But savvy was a fine expression that everybody used it. Oh, Savvy? You know what I mean? Yeah. That's what Lewis is referring to. He doesn't use that very crude word, however. I really never even knew it. But savoir is just to know about something, and that kind of knowing about is not in the category of what Lewis means when he says to know something. To know something, you know it as a subject. You know it as a person who acts on knowledge. And when you read Lewis's book, you have to be a knower. And you know it from the internal kind of knowledge that you've beaten it out and it's become a part of you. This is absolutely essential. And if you think if you think you've read Lewis and you haven't been changed in your attitudes of thinking and living, then you haven't read it. Any more than you read the New Testament and you haven't changed to anything. It's the same kind of writing in terms of insisting that it has to happen to you. The difference is, of course, that with Lewis, this is not a divine scripture or anything. It's just a new consciousness raising. And I really have to go through that with her and tell her, that it was going to be a pitfall, a real hole, if she kept on with that. Because you don't raise your consciousness. What Lewis is talking about is something quite different. It's something that happens to you as you become more and more aware of the glory of being a human being. And that being a human being is that you're aware. It's awareness, too, is another word for it. Mm-hmm. And now, so what you've been doing this year, this is what's been happening to you. Quote. Or, just to know, it doesn't mean that you don't have to learn things faster. Certainly Lewis is one person that believes firmly in knowing a fact is a fact and knowing a truth is a truth. And I was very happy to know that he had trouble in the relationship. He was very happy that he didn't have to take his exams in math because it was during the war and they were able to waive that particular examination because they needed him to teach, and it was the Second World War. He'd been in the First World War, and I think it was. It wasn't the Second World War. He took those tests and he was teaching them already. No, it was the First World War, but anyway, he was hurried through, and he said that was the only examination he was worried about for his band. Yeah, Clive, faithful, dear son, glad to hear I have an affinity with you someplace. But it didn't mean that he didn't believe that he had to learn those numbers, because he did. And the way in which he writes, you can tell that he hadn't been skipping his homework. Homer does a kind of a good thing, I think, in the way in which he lays out his book. He has the first chapter is a little bit about Lewis in general, then about theories and literature, and then he has one on the virtues, which Lewis was always pumping for, the old-fashioned virtues, of honest, being honest and being prudent and being fair and a lot of things that we just sort of poo-poo down and don't make any difference. And then he has a marvelous chapter on what people are, and I'm going to spend a little time on that because it is an excellent analysis of how Lewis saw people and what they needed. And then his last chapter is on theology and God. Just a brief little skimming on what we call, when we talk about a group of writings, we call it the corpus, the body of his work, the kinds of things he wrote. He wrote about 40 or 50 books. And he was a man, as you know, of learning. And he had a classical education in background, so that he was a scholar in the Renaissance and the medieval period, and he was able to pick up his Greek and Latin without any great difficulty, and that's, I almost thought this morning, well, maybe I should just talk on the lost tools of learning that Dorothy Sayers, that I heard to the other day in Dorothy Sayers' essay, because of the fact that the kind of training that Lewis had, although you don't always see it because you don't read the book about this kind of image, which is on the Renaissance literature, or you don't read about the other things that he's written that are specifically related to a literary field, but they're there nonetheless. That kind of a discipline is there to produce the kind of writing that you know as C.S. Lewis. And you might think that it doesn't take anything but a good imagination to write a Narnia book. Well, that imagination had to be disciplined and trained through many, many years of careful study in order to make the Narnia book the kind of beautiful, casually delightful things that they are. And they cover the learning. They don't exploit it. But a lot of that is in just the descriptions of the kinds of things like the caravel and some of the things like that are so exciting and so beautiful, are all part of Lewis's own background. Well, that imagination had to be disciplined and trained through many, many years of careful study in order to make the Narnia books the kind of beautiful, casually delightful things that they are. And they cover the learning. They don't exploit it. But a lot of that is in just the descriptions of the kinds of things like the caravel and some of the things like that are so exciting and so beautiful are all part of Lewis's own background. Lewis began in about, I think, about 36. He wrote The Allegory of Love, and after that he wrote about a dozen books of literary criticism and the history of literature. He was one of the writers for the Cambridge History, and wrote the whole section on the Renaissance period. He wrote poetry. He wanted to write a long poem. How many of you have read the biography by Roger Langston Green? It's really a very good biography. And although Roger Green is a devoted student of Lewis, and therefore there is a bias naturally, still he does. There are some sections in it where he has had to tell it like it is, so to speak, and he's willing to do that. And he doesn't mince matters, and it's very, very good. And in that book, he talks about the fact that Lewis really wanted to write a long poem. He wanted to write an epic. All these English professors who really loved the epic style and the long poems and loved the legends of England, particularly the Arthur legend, all wanted to write a long poem on this subject. And he tried. He wrote one long poem, and it didn't do very well. I think they've published it now, because anything that Lewis has written becomes good material, and it gets sold. But he's not sold for that reason. But this book, Dimer, is one of them. And I think he's written a book of short poems. You might peek into them sometime if you haven't. They're really, some of them are delightful. He's got a really good one on outer space, and the fact that you, and this was written before the moonshot or anything, and really the end of it is quite a little, it kind of makes you sit up and realize, you know, what have we really accomplished? We get to the moon and we've brought ourselves with us. Lewis's scholarship
as such, his whole literary criticism, his historical writing in terms of literature, all has to be read on its own. He doesn't write literary criticism in the same way that everybody else does. He has a real sense, and I guess that's why I've always liked him as a literary critic. He is adamant on getting you into the text. Meredith knows when we talk about books that are going to be in the bookstore, I always say, well, I'd really like to get more of the source books here and fewer books about what's been written. Because I felt this when I was in graduate school, that the writing of books about, and then finally about, is there's no end to it. And finally, you never get back to what the author really said, because you've got such a barrage and such a lot of defenses beforehand that the author can no longer speak to you. And you remember what Dorothy Sayers says about a good poet means what he says, and he speaks to all of us as we read it. He addresses us where we are. And you know, you don't get that if you read too much literary criticism. And Lewis, in his book, A Personal Heresy, with another professor, Tillyard, in a discussion in literary criticism, two little things that are put together, he develops very, very profoundly and clearly what he understands to be the meaning of any poem and any piece of writing. You enter into that. The poet expects you to enter into that piece of writing. He has his own structure. He's got a reason for choosing the words that he's choosing. And he has a right to expect that you will be able to enter into that kind of an experience that he has had. But on the other hand, you also bring some of your own experiences to it. The trouble with a lot of literary criticism is that it's the literary critic's interpretation, not the poet's, that is being discussed. And so you get a lot of somebody else's idea rather than the impact firsthand. Mm-hmm.
So we had a big discussion with a friend of ours at the University of Chicago, British School in English.
Mm-hmm. It's all criticism.
And he's very happy when they said it's a creative, it's the way people get involved, that's where you're the subject,
uh-huh.
As a reader and as a writer, and it's completely, and he's an extremely good student, one of the top students.
So that actually, that what is being discussed is no longer important.
It's not the work.
Not the work itself.
The
well, you see, this is what happens in theology, isn't it? It's all the theological discussions about the New Testament that are important, finally, not the New Testament itself. So the New Testament gets at the bottom of the list, and you never get to it because you're so busy reading all the stuff that's preparatory to reading it. And it was never intended to be written that way. It was never intended to be read that way. Well, Lewis is very firm in that, although he himself writes criticism. So you see, in a sense, you always are belying what you're saying and doing the thing that you don't, you maybe are speaking against. But he does speak that, he does talk about this in order to clarify the situation so that you don't take simply a whole batch of somebody else's opinions and say, uh-huh, that's it. Now then I know what it means. And that means nothing ever happens to you. You do not become the knower, in other words, if you are resting in somebody else's critique of the work. And this is important, and you see how it goes right into the theological work from the literary work, because it isn't just true of his literary, of how he interprets literature, but this is also true of the way in which you understand all of life and the way in which you finally become a real person. You don't talk or read about life, you live it. You enter into it. And this is, oh, this is so important that you can't say it enough. But he does, one of the things that he insists on in his literary criticism, and this is paramount in his writing about the Christian life as well, and that is that there are certain laws of structure that you have to abide by. There are certain principles in a poem, for instance, like the comedy, and we talked about the way in which allegory or images are understood. Now, Lewis says, this, you have to understand that there are certain laws that hold for that kind of writing, and in order to understand it, you have to abide by the kind of structure that kind of thing is written in. Now this, he says, is also true of the way in which you read Scripture, the way in which you understand Christianity. And it was a whole new way of interpreting it. So that instead of becoming he didn't want to be an apologist, he said he wasn't a theologian, and he wasn't. But what he was doing was getting people to think about Christianity in a different way according to the rules of the game, so to speak. And that was because he had understood very clearly and explicited it very clearly in terms of literature, that there are rules of the game that you follow in reading a piece of literature. There are also rules of the game that you follow when you enter into the world of Christianity. There are rules of the game that you follow when you enter into the world of science. You don't make your own rules for everything. You have to understand that. And this is why his writing and his works on Christianity are so fresh, because he doesn't apologize for them. He doesn't try to make them fit a scientific rationale. He says, you don't apply those rules here. They don't belong here. And we'll come to that when we see what Homer says about that. Most of you, I think, know about his science trilogy and his Narnia books. I don't know how many of you have read them. How many of you have read the Narnia books? I hope most of you have read them. I'm not checking you out, but I carefully put my eyes down so I wouldn't look. But I just wanted you to be able to put your hands up and know that you have been counted or not counted. You see, that is a choice, you see, right there. You are making a choice, or making yourself, you know, a conscious person, even in saying, I have or I haven't. I like what Homer says about the way in which the space trilogy, the Perelandra and Out of the Silent Planet and That Hideous Strength, how they affect our thinking. He says they make a very imposing trio of interplanetary adventures. And as we said before in discussing all these writers, they write books that are good as pure entertainment. They don't have to be read because they're Christian. I know they're good for me. That's why I bought them. And you don't mind, do you? No, I don't. I think it's all right that you spent your money that way, Mary. Oh, of course, you've got too many books already, but, you know, you've got such a noble thought. I mean, that kind of defense doesn't work in these books. You don't have to buy them because they're Christian. They're not Christian books, so-called. They're written by a Christian, and they have implications all over the place for reflective and thoughtful Christians. But they can be read by non-Christians, and they may not even swallow the beat. You know, it just depends on whether they're paying attention. And it's like Homer says, this whole business of the consciousness that Lewis is concerned with depends a lot on where you are when you read the book, if you're going to be affected by it, and if you're going to become a knower or not. Well, he says, but in an almost incidental and casual way, all kinds of other concerns besides an interplanetary adventure are addressed too. By choosing to project scenes on another planet, and this is a really very well put sentence, where vices have no institutional status. think that's a rather good little clause. Where vices have no institutional status, where laws are not necessary, where shame is unknown, one sees in very stark and forbidding fashion what greed, ambition, and self-centeredness finally have done for our world and its inhabitants. Now you know that out of the silent planet, that our planet is the lost planet. The rest of the planets are still related to the creator, the God of all, and that we've fallen. And because of that, we can't relate to anybody. And so when Ransom goes to, takes this wild trip, he discovers this, they land on this planet, and he discovers all these things that are going on there without any vice. It has no institutional status there. There isn't shame. There isn't anything like that. And people live. One of the things that I loved about that was the fact, you remember that there was fear? I don't know if you remember that, but I thought, you know, the nicest thing, I am such a fearful person. I mean, I really am full of fear. I get scared of the dark and, you know, going up behind Shelley 9, you know, after everybody's moved out and wondering if I'm going to run into the Sasquatch or something. And I always think heaven really is going to be great, not going to have anything to be afraid of. And Lewis is very, it's really exciting because he says there is fear. They are afraid because there's another group of beings on this planet that are a threat, and yet they're not an evil threat, but they are a threat. Remember that? Maybe it's a long time since you read it, and some of you haven't. Well, I would advise you to read that out of the Silent Planet. It's a real dose to read it. I used to like to read Revelation at one sitting just to kind of get me out of my feeling that I was, you know, this is the best possible world and we'll just make it do. And I'd read Revelation not with any not trying to understand the symbolism or anything, but just because it just cleaned me up and made me realize that this is not the end of all things. And sometimes, you know, you begin to feel that freeways and good roads and proper sewage systems and the whole business are all, you know, that's all there is to it. Well, it's good to read Revelations. I'll recommend that book too, by the way. But that is really something to read out of the Silent Planet. If you can't read all of them, read that one, because it does give you a really good kind of shock treatment over against our own planet. And in this reading of the novels of Lewis, Homer says this: Lewis is making overt or apparent that we cannot quite judge institutions and people, the world and its planners, until we get a standard. In other words, how do we get any idea of what's wrong with our world if we don't have a standard to judge by? These novels do that almost by the way. Their power is also to cause the reader to observe and to articulate the differences between the sinless and the sinful. One becomes increasingly aware of the mixed proportions that we humans are. Being neither completely vicious nor virtuous, neither sinner nor saint, we have all the more reason given us to seek integrity and truth and to avoid compromising half measures. A kind of longing for a purer state is born in us by the reading. Now, I want you to pay attention to that, because this is what I was talking about before and what Elise said John has tried to get through all year with this whole understanding of reading, that something happens to you in the reading. And that's why you can't read in a kind of a half asleep state. You have to read paying attention to what you're reading. And it's why Bateman said, for example, when he dedicated the Koinonia Library, the meditation library, he said a lot of people believe in speed reading, but he said, I think over this library we should put read as slowly as you can. And really, it's true. This rapid reading is great for collecting things that aren't, you know, that you have to kind of just get a lot of facts accrued in a hurry and be able to talk about them with a great deal of authority saying, I read that. But if something's to happen to you, you can't read that way. And Lewis is not to be read in a skim and jump fashion. In accord with Lewis's appreciation of the richness of every person's powers and capacity, he soon is both eliciting in us what is dimly there already and then appealing to it rather richly. I refer to that dim awareness and hope we all have of and for a life everlasting, for a kind of purity and innocence of love and beauty, for being perfect and incredibly sweet and at rest with ourselves, others, and the world. It is as if Lewis's fiction sounds a bell for us. It sounds a bell for us, and I think that's right. It doesn't, you know, spell it all out, but it rings a bell, and someplace inside of us, there's an echo or a recognition that, you know, the bell tolls for us, and not in the depressing way that John Donne talks about it, but in the feeling that I've got this feeling too. I've got an inkling of the same feeling, in other words. The author dares to think that every one of us is already a living dialectic, a psychomachia containing striking opposites. Now, he uses this word psychomachia, but I think, I don't know if that's the right way to pronounce it. I forgot to ask Carol, but he's not always right in pronouncing words, but I usually ask him if it's Greek. But what he's talking about is the Schauplatz that Luther talks about, that our hearts and our consciousness and our lives are a living drama that's going on continually. Conflicts and forces and pros and cons that are battling and working out a drama within us. And he says this is the kind of thing that Lewis plays to and appeals to in all of his writing. He makes you aware that you are a Schauplatz. You are a stage. You are a theater inside of you in which there's a lot going on. I mean, can you be dull? Can you be boring if you've got that kind of thing going on inside of you? Of course not. And human beings are not dull. When they're not living as human beings and when they're living as patterns of other people, of course they're dull. You know, they don't know what's going on. But when you do, then it's exciting. And Lewis says, this is what it means to pay attention, to be alert. He says, these terms sound outlandishly learned. So an explanation is in order. Lewis thinks that heaven and hell, vice and virtue, wretchedness and happiness, grandeur and degradation are real possibilities for our thought. Now, you and I think that, we're so little and unimportant. You know, what have we got to talk about heaven and hell and greatness and littleness? I mean, we're just in the middle. You know, it's just pure laziness that we think that way. Pure laziness. Because we don't want to be responsible for anything bigger than just the middle of the road. You know, if you've got to go to the edge or you're going to be a pathfinder or a trailblazer, you've got to be responsible out in front for something. It's much easier and cozier and more comfortable if you say, I'll let somebody else do that. I don't want to be responsible. And so we think we're being modest when we're being lazy. And this is something Lewis cannot allow for. He says, we have a native psychological equipment to which and by which our lives are advanced, planned, and judged. This is to comment upon the opposites, the conflicting passions that beset us, and to indulge the notion that our lives are like a lived dialogue or a lived dialectic, a mutual confrontation of opposites out of which we have to make some sense. Here then is the state of our minds and hearts, a kind of psychomachia, opposite seeking resolution in a successful life. Now, this is what we've got inside of us, and it isn't the kind of introspection in which you just kind of, you know, grovel around in all the sins and the worminess of your insides and how horrible you are and what a sinner you are and how terrible you are, but that you realize you are redeemed, you are a son of God, you are able to live in His light, and that you are continually living in forgiveness, and therefore you are able to admit these conflicts. You don't just walk around and bite your nails about it, but you allow the conflict to be open, and then when you read the great works of literature, you can enter into them, and you grow in those works of literature because they strike a resounding, recognized note in you. You see, you realize that when you read Dante, if you're aware of yourself as having that kind of a map of hell and heaven inside of you, as Dante says we do have, or if you read Milton's Paradise Lost, there are plenty of places in it that I would skip because they're very dull and long, but there are places that really, and I'm going to read some of the a little bit of the analysis that Lewis gives you in the preface to Paradise Lost of the temptation of Eve, and you recognize it's me, that's the way I am. You know, that's exactly the history of my last temptation. Apologies to Kazantzakis. I mean, you know, the last time I was tempted, I can remember it very clearly. It was only, you know, like 2 minutes ago. And I know exactly how this builds up. And if you are aware of this, and you're aware of the way in which also the Lord is able to, you know, weave you in and out of these things, I mean, there's an exciting, interesting drama going on in you all the time. Well, you say, if I'm going to keep on looking at myself all the time, how am I going to be able to see my neighbor? Well, you know, I'm not suggesting that you're just going to be so preoccupied, and I don't think anybody in this room is that much of an introvert that you're going to sit and look at yourself all the time and never look out. But it's just that you are somewhat aware when you read that this is something that has to do with me. It's not something out here that I'm going to get a mark on. So one of the great things about this lifestyle course is that you don't get grades. You don't get credit. There's been a lot of push for getting credit. But you know, the stuff that you don't get credit for is really probably what is eventually going to mean the most to you. It's what's going to get down inside of you, because you don't have to pass it off and say, this is what I learned. See? You know, and hang it on in front. But this is something that happens as you become the knower. And Lewis always wants us to remember, and this is from the Allegory of Love, humanity does not pass through phases as a train passes through stations. Being alive, humanity has the privilege of always moving, yet never leaving anything behind. You think of what a lot of freight we carry. I mean, just think of what it's going to be like when you get to be as old as I am. You know, you're getting to your 60s, you've got such a freight, you wonder that you can move, if that is internally. But that's true, you see, and you're continually selecting from that past, from all the things that have happened to you, and that have happened to the race, besides. It's unbelievable. You really almost need a microfilm kind of a consciousness to catch, to be with it. But that's why it's important to take, to pay attention, to be able to select, to be able to use all these things that are part of us. Homer has a couple of neat little things to say about the Narnia books, and I'm just going to just read them very quickly. He refers to them because he says, after all, it's Narnia is full of strange beings and interesting and exciting. But he says, More interestingly, the royalty and the subjects also have to learn to be subjects of Aslan, that magnificent lion. Aslan is not quite tame, and his nature is not totally describable by the conventional rules and precepts.